David Bohm Seminar Series 1, November 8, 1987, 10 o'clock morning session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Well, I want to say that we were discussing yesterday an approach to things like anger to get some perception. And I wanted to emphasize that it is not, you know, that if you say bring it up, you know, call it up by means of words and so on, what you're causing your anger. This is a kind of point of departure for further exploring. It's not just a way of sort of a routine or a method that you go through to try to deal with anger. You see that it's a way in, you see, to get started. You see, to find out, when you try this, you've got to be very observant and find out what happens and make further steps, you see, that don't just stop there. But, for example, you may discover that you can't suspend anger. And then you have to say, you know, why not? Begin to inquire, you know, and find the thoughts that are stopping you, and so on. You're starting an inquiry which has no, which may go on and on, right? Much, much deeper. And in this inquiry, we're looking always for the more general. You see, now that may seem abstract at first, because part of our tradition is the general is always abstract, and in some cases it is, right? Because in some cases, you have a particular objects like chairs, then the general class of chairs, right? Which is much more abstract than a particular chair, right? And then you could have the general class of things that you can sit on, still more benches and various other rocks and other things. And you could then go into the general class of solid objects and so on and so on. You see, making it more and more abstract in general. But that is not what I mean by the general, right? I mean by the general, the generative, that if you take a tree, the source is and the roots and the trunk generates it all, and then the branches branch out. Now, if you pick on a particular branch, I call that an abstraction, you see, because you're taking it out. The word abstract means literally to take out in Latin. And you are taking, in your mind, you are taking it out of the context of the whole tree, right, and looking at it separately. So looking at a separate object in that sense is to make it abstract. So you can get confused by saying picking something particular is very concrete, but it can be very abstract, right? Some little problem is an abstraction, right? And therefore, we have to be careful about what we really mean by abstract and concrete. I say that in the case of finding the general root of something, the source of the stream, the general is the most concrete. it's that from which everything generates. And that's a very important point. Now, I think that one can illustrate that in terms of what I would call the structure of mistakes, you see. You see, we make mistakes of various kinds, and we tend to think of them as isolated, particular, right? And try to, but these mistakes are all connected up. So you can't solve your particular mistake. You see, suppose, for example, we consider that person who was easily subject to flattery. That person would say, finally, I see that's a mistake. You know, I shouldn't be flattered so easily. Shouldn't fall for it. And then he says, that's my particular problem, flattery. That's my problem. I've got to solve it. Don't bother me with these abstract generalities. But then he discovers that in spite of all his best resolutions, he falls for it again and again, right? And the reason is that it's connected with many other problems that he's got another problem, more fundamental, which is that he's giving the self-image a tremendous value. Right? That may come from still other problems that went back to his childhood, you know, in all sorts of ways that have been mentioned. You know, it could connect up to the society in which you feel you must have a good present a good self-image, or else you can't get anywhere. You know, and so on. So your problems are all connected up. You see that there's a whole series of problems. Now, first of all, one gives rise to another. The problem of giving too much value to the self-image will give rise to the problem of being easily flattered, right? Therefore, I say that entrains it. There's an entrainment of problems. One entrains the other, right? You've got a train of problems. Now, then besides that, the problems cross each other because, see, the next problem is that when that person discovers he's been taken advantage of, he gets angry and says, you know, it was outrageous and unforgivable that he should take advantage of my trust in this manner. And therefore he gets angry. And well, that may get worse, right? therefore we have the entanglement of one problem in another. See, that may entangle further because he'll get angry and then he'll say, you know, he'll say, I shouldn't be angry. Or he may say, he may blame, the next problem is he may blame the other, he's blamed the other fellow, but instead of blaming the other fellow, he may blame himself now and feel guilty. Well, that'll also muddle him up some more, and that's still another problem he's got. And that obviously is connected up with society, which says you shouldn't be easily flattered, you shouldn't let yourself be made a fool of, and so on. It's very bad to have present that image. And it goes on, you see, and then he can go on further and make more problems because he'll say, you know, somebody will say, you know, you keep on falling for this stuff and you keep on making these mistakes, though you know they're wrong. There must be something wrong with you. Really. And it could say there's some evil in you that makes you do all these wrong things, though you know they're wrong. You know, therefore you've got to be punished, you see, to you know, you must punish yourself, feel very guilty, right? Maybe that will help, and so on. And you see, then you can say, then people have made the theory that when we do all these things, when we know they're wrong, it means you're evil. There's an evil there, something wrong. And we have the principle of evil, which is making people do all these wrong things, though they know they're wrong all over the world. And we say that there's evil in the world, and we've got to fight it with good. We've got another problem. And you see, it leads to the whole international scene, like saying the Iranians are calling the United States the great Satan, which is carrying this to a tremendous extreme, right? And I think Reagan has called Russia the evil empire, and many such words have been used all throughout. You know, in the First World War, the Germans were called the Huns, you know, which suggests they were really quite evil. The point is that we have this entrainment and entanglement of mistakes, right? We have a web of mistakes. You're caught on one part of the web and you say, that's my problem, right? It's like the insect caught in the spider's web, and it assumes by instinct that it's a local problem. All it's got to do is move and push that obstacle out of the way, you see? But the more it moves, the more it entangles, right? See, if the insect could advise it, it would say, please first stop these movements, right? And then maybe you could find a way out of the web, right? So we have this web of entrained and entangled mistakes, you see. Any single particular problem is only part of this tremendous web. And therefore your problems are connected to more and more and eventually to totality. Perhaps you'll never get hold of the whole thing, right? It goes back through the whole human race, the whole of society, the whole of the past, and it's all, you know, part of this web, right? So that's a very key point, and we're saying to get some general feeling for it is important. To get the source of where all this web is generated, you see, somewhere in some more subtle, deeper order, the web is being generated. You see, whereas it's no use fighting this web, and it's no use trying to reach the end of it by going from one strand to another. Although it will be useful to do that for a while in order to get familiar with the web, to be really convinced that you are caught in a web and you just don't have a bunch of particular problems, right? You see that you can say, well, certain problems, practical ones, can be solved in particular, but when it comes to these psychological problems, they are a whole web, and you're entrained and entangled, right? And the attempts to get out of this web are getting us entangled more. You see, that this has been the whole history of humanity, that people's ways of getting out, have made it a lot worse.
Including psychotherapy?
It could, but I'm saying that I think that there's some value in certain features of psychotherapy, but other features could easily be part of this web, you see. and many other things of the same nature. You see, for example, if the psychotherapist assumes that it is the function of the profession to adapt you to society, then that will get you further in the web, because if the society is itself the source of this web, and you want to, it will get you to accept it, right? You see, whereas, you know that, on the other hand, if you say that the function is to get more insight into what's going on, then it might be different, right? Now, the, but certainly a great deal of our morality gets us into this web more deeply. I'm not advocating immorality, because that's another part of the web. But I'm saying that moralistic injunctions are part of the web, right? Saying be good, you know, be strong, be virtuous, right? Because, you know, you can't, right, if you're caught in this web. Not until you understand, you know, what it means, right?
You seem to be leading to the fact that we get caught in a network of problems, and yet if we understand the whole nature of trouble, problem-making, when and if you solve one problem, then it leads to solving all problems.
Well, if you see the general principle behind that one problem, it will be the same behind all. But also, you see, part of the principle is that each problem is connected to a vast set of others, right? You don't have an isolated problem. That's the first thing to see.
I guess most of us don't see it that way, and that's the reason we get caught in that web.
Yes, it's the whole culture and the society and the past history, and, you know, for thousands of years, right? We pick it up subliminally from the culture, or from the whole way people do things, right?
Are we saying in a way that life is problems?
No, not necessarily. There are problems and problems, you see. There are certain problems, practical problems, which you will always have, right? But I'm saying the psychological problems having to do with contradiction, the typical problem of contradiction is that I have good reason to be angry, and yet I mustn't be angry, right? Now that makes a problem. So how am I to solve that, those two requirements, that one I have good reason to be angry, and the other is I shouldn't be angry? And not merely, maybe moralistically I'm told not to be angry, or else I realize by thinking about it that it's really not getting me anywhere. It's foolish, it's producing bad results, and so on. So I say, that's my problem. What am I to do when I say I have good reason to be angry, and yet it's very bad to be angry? You see, that's a problem, right? It's not really a problem, because there's no solution, right? but we treat it as a problem, right? But that's connected. That problem is not isolated, as I explained. It's connected to a whole bunch of other similar things, right? A whole web of them, a whole network of them, right? Which goes on and on, you know, beyond any limits we can see.
Is this web a web of thought?
It's a web of thought connected with feeling. If we think of thought extending out into the body, into the feeling, and into the society, then I'll call it thought, right? If you think of thought as just intellect, then it's not thought, right? Not only thought, it's everything else, right?
Hmm? Well, if we think of the problem as being having to do with the self, and my self-image, and I am the thinker and the controller and the doer and the feeler and the emoter and the everything else, that whole pattern there, but still that comes under thought, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We can use the one word thought to represent it all. Mm-hmm. That's what Krishnamurti does, actually, but other people use thought in another sense to represent only the intellect, right? See, that's where one of the confusions is, that different people use words in different ways, and we have to be careful how we are using the word. And whenever you're talking with someone, you must find out how that person is using the word, right? Or else explain how you want to use it, right? Otherwise, there's going to be confusion. Now, if thought means only the intellect, then it will be rather puzzling to say all our problems come only from thought, right?
How about the universe that is inhabited by the self? Is that covered?
Yes, the self, insofar as it includes thought and feeling and desire and will and the whole neurophysiological activity and the whole connection to society and the culture, right?
Well, but it's all right to use thought factually. We need it. We need a map of the place where you live or you can't get home and so on. And all of the facts, you know, history and geography and just to get around on the planet and make decisions and do your job, you need all kinds of facts. No, so the problem with thought then is something else. Right?
Yeah, well, you not only need facts, you need inferences, you need to draw conclusions, you know, you need to use the whole process of thought, reason, that is to go from one thought to another in an orderly way, right?
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
So, but then there is going to be a thought, see, let's try to... there's going to be a kind of thought which gets into these problems, right? We've sort of been hinting at what it is. It creates that division of the observer and the observed. It's a false kind of thought, right? It does not see the distinction. It does not see the connection between what thought, the intellectual part of thought, and what happens from that, right? And it treats that as different. It gets into terrible confusion and to wrong values, right? You see, so maybe we could say now that one of the problems with thought, see, if we're going to find out how does thought go wrong, you see, that's really our question, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, suppose we say there is thought which is useful, factual, rational, orderly, you know, even inventive, and so on, and, you know, all sorts of good things it may do, right? It has created the whole world that we see, and it could create an immensely better world if it were only orderly, right? Now, even as confused as it is, it has produced practically everything we see, right? So, therefore, we're not condemning thought as such, right? But there is a certain way thought goes wrong which we have to look at. Now, we have got to understand it. It's no use even condemning that, but it's just that it has to be seen and understood.
Well, it's not that type of thought is not. We're not dealing with something wrong either. We're just trying to understand it.
That's right. You see, it's a mistake. You see, let's put it that we're making mistakes. Now, mistakes have to be rectified, right?
Yeah.
Now, if we said that the trouble was due to an intrinsic evil in the human nature, we'd say, what are we going to do? You see, how do we rectify that? You see, you could say, well, some mysterious thing will have to happen, right? You know. Maybe some act of faith could do it. Maybe if you were punished enough in hellfire for 10 million years, it would be purified. That was one of the theories which was common in Europe for a long time.
Rather fond of the devil myself.
What?
Rather fond of the devil myself.
Well, you haven't really had any real experience with him, you see. Perhaps if you remember the joke, you're only as a tourist. The point is that there was this, we've had this theory that people will go through purgatory for heaven knows for X million years to be purified of their evil, right? Of whatever is wrong with them. And having been refined in this crucible, they will come out pure, bright, and clean. It hasn't really helped. People were really terrified of hellfire during the Middle Ages. It produced tremendous fear, right? Panic. Mm. Now the there are all sorts of theories, you see, as to what we can make these theories, but then we have to watch out. The theory that we make about this has a tremendous effect on how it goes, right? The theory is not about something else that it's theorizing about, but rather the theory is part of what it is theorizing about. Do you see? The observer is in the observed, the observer is the observed, the observed is the observer, right? The theory helps to produce the very thing that it is theorizing about. Because thought flows into the rest of reality. Thought is real, and it flows into... See, the point is that we're discussing about fantasy. We were saying, from the infant's point of view, he starts out with fantasy, and a particular kind of fantasy is what is called reality, right? But vice versa, a particular part of reality is what we call fantasy. We have to see it both ways, or else... See, if we say that there's nothing but fantasy, then we're going to get very confused.
Einstein claimed that nuclear physics was a myth. He's right.
Well, in some sense, all theories could be called myths, you see. In ancient times, myths were the ways people made theories of the world, right? They were done poetically. And then eventually people got to believe in them literally, and that was the mistake, right? Now, See, our present, every theory has the role of a kind of myth which gives insight. You see, like a drama does not need not portray historical characters, but it may portray characters that never existed, but if it does them rightly, it gives insight. Now, the theory is like a map. It's a story which gives you insight, and it does not necessarily a literal representation of reality. You see, there was a fellow called Alfred Korzybski who used to say, whatever we say anything is, it isn't, you see. It may be similar to what we say, but it's also different, and also it's more and different, right? What we say cannot cover the whole of what is, and also there are bound to be mistakes in it if we keep on extending it, right? Therefore, thought is limited, right? That's another way of putting it. So the on the other hand, some people have assumed that thought is, some certain thoughts are unlimited, that exactly what things are is exactly what we say they are, right? And that is a mistake, you see, because that mistake can lead to excessive value being given to your thought. This is one of the steps by which thought goes wrong. It gets too high a value. You see, so the point is that thought must be given its right value, and then it will go right. Now, this leads us to the question of value in general, because we cannot just look at the value of thought and say as a particular problem and all other values can be put aside. You know, we look at this one little thread, right, of the web. So the point is, what is value, you see, because you can begin to see the importance of value. The word value is based on the Latin root, the same root as the English, valor and valiant, means strength, right? And you see, valid means it's strong, and invalid is one who has no strength. And if the document is valid, it has strength, right? if the check is stamped invalid, then it will not work, right? So the point is that a value in some way has to do with some notion about the strength, you see. And strength itself has value, right? So we say there are values of all kinds. You see, we may say something is important, something is useful, right? Something is good, something is bad, something is beautiful, something is ugly. I like it, I don't like it. These are all valuations, right? And you see the power of value, that a value determines priority, right? The highest value has the highest priority, the highest strength. And the supreme value has absolute priority. Right? So therefore values are extremely dynamic. You see, thoughts might be just sitting there, very, insubstantial and, unimportant, right? Idly floating by. And then suddenly, and they have no effect, you see, they have no value. And suddenly you say, this is terribly important, right? And then your whole system is mobilized, right? So therefore, value is what gives power, energy, strength, and dynamism to thought. Now, this is important because, therefore, thoughts are not just sitting in an ethereal, abstract realm. They immediately become dynamic, active, powerful, and dominant. You see, thought given value dominates you, right? If it has supreme value. You see, one of the values is necessity. You see that reality is a value. You judge it to be real, that makes it valuable. To judge it to be illusion makes it nothing, right? No significance, right? Truth is a value, and if you think it's true, it's very important. If it's false, then it either has no value or a negative value, right? You see, evil has a negative value, something to be avoided, right? And so you see value, and now necessity is a value. What is necessary cannot be otherwise, right? The Latin root necessi means don't yield, right? If something is necessary, that is a valuation whose dynamic activity in the person is an attitude of not yielding, right? You've got to do it, right? You've got to keep at it if it's necessary. If it's absolutely necessary, there's no way out, right? You've got to never yield, right? You see, so that can produce rigidity. You see, so these are all values. You have truth, and then we have many other values. You can see their power, right? What is necessary, what is right, what is good, what is true. If all these come together, then you really accept that those are the values that will mobilize you tremendously against what is bad and so on. Therefore, all thought is permeated with these values, right? And the whole system. Those values permeate the whole body, the whole neurophysiological system, right?
Is it primarily tacit?
Yes, that's right. We don't usually state our values. They're usually tacit or implicit, right? Sometimes we state them, but usually we just act according to them. We don't even have to think about them, right? Because they may be picked up without your ever having stated them, by just implicitly from the way people behave, and they show you what their values are and what they think your values should be, right? Saying you should be a certain kind of person. Masculinity could become a value exaggerated to machismo. And femininity is another value which could be exaggerated. And and so on, you see. But you see the power of these values. And behind them, most of the struggles of society have these values behind them.
Do you think it's important for people to make them explicit?
Well, we have, yes, some of them should be made explicit, those that have contradictions in them, you see. We can't make them all explicit. Obviously, we'd spend our whole life at it. I give an example. You see, between the West and the East, we have communism and capitalism. Now, in the West, the higher value is the individual, and in the East, at least, we profess individual as the highest value, and in the East, they profess the collective society as the highest value, right, the welfare. Actually, both sides don't really believe either of these, but still, merely to have professed them has a powerful effect, even when you don't act according to them, right? We don't have to say that because you have values, you act according to them, right? Everybody says good is a high value, and yet many people, there's a great deal of, there's not good going on, you see. Both sides may have tremendous number of values in common, but just differing on this creates an irreconcilable conflict, right? That there's no way, if you say these are supreme values, you see, saying they take precedence over all others, then you cannot negotiate about them and you can't argue. You see, all the negotiations are just of a secondary significance. There's no real way to settle the issue. Even if they should both stop believing these values altogether and continue to profess them, there would be no way to solve the problem. Because everybody would be compelled to pretend that he believes it all. And see, even those who want to change it are compelled to talk as if they believed it, right? Right. For example, Gorbachev wants to change many things, but he cannot really question these fundamental values, right? And anybody who wanted to change things in this side also would not be able, you know, if he can say more about it here, but nobody will really take it seriously. if you really, very few, right? So the, now, So the and that happens in science too. You see, there was a long series of discussions between Einstein and Bohr, who are two of the leading physicists of this century, and they couldn't agree on certain points. You see, they were arguing about certain points in the quantum theory, and it would be technical to go into it. But essentially, they kept on talking, and they couldn't. They kept on repeating their arguments until they finally stopped talking. There was no point to it, you see, and they sort of drifted apart, but though they had been very close, you see, so, and very goodwill and so on. And the essentially, they disagreed on values in scientific theory. See, what kind of theory would be an appropriate vehicle of truth, you see? That is, Einstein thought the theory ought to be objective and clear and unambiguous, and Bohr thought the other way. And most of their, they seemed to be arguing about science, but that was at cross purposes. As long as they talked about science, they could never get to the point of what was between them. They never really got to the point between them and talked about it.
In this case, their values were perhaps stated, but maybe axiomatic, so even though it's...
Well, no, most of it was implicit. They seldom stated, they didn't actually state, they stated it, but it was sort of, was not the main, didn't seem to be the main point they were arguing about. Well, I think, and see, for example, Einstein would say that Bohr had a tranquilizer philosophy, And Bohr said Einstein had gone in a reactionary way against his own revolutionary achievements. And see, in that way, they were indicating their values, right? But they did not really get down to it and say, look, here, we've got a conflict of values. You see, they were talking as if we have a disagreement about science. And you see, the same thing happens in attempts of in Geneva. You see, they're not getting, they're saying, we disagree about how many weapons of this kind and how many weapons of that kind everybody should have. And we've got to negotiate all that, you see. But they're not, that's not really the point, right? See, if they could agree on values, there would be no problem. You see, you take before the Second World War, the Japanese were regarded as very dangerous enemies, you know, here. And after the war, when they got now, you see, the Japanese felt they had to conquer vast areas in Asia in order to supply themselves with raw materials. But not the Japanese had the great good fortune to be defeated by the United States, who then built, who then helped them develop their industry. And therefore, they now get all the raw materials by trade, right? Far more than they would ever have gotten from conquering China.
Cheaper, too.
Cheaper, yeah. So the Russians could get what they wanted, the Americans could get what they wanted, if only we would stop this conflict of values and the belief we've got to fight about it, right? Now, the and everybody would benefit, you see. But you see that so these values, which actually people don't really believe too much anyway, are still the object of contention. That there's really not a great deal of individualism left in the United States, and there is not a great, and also this belief in the collective, and is not actually carried out strongly in practice. I mean, each person is for himself, you know, working his way up the bureaucracy or whatever. So they're really not terribly different in their fundamental way they really operate deep down, but because they profess different values, that makes all the difference. You see, you might argue that happens between two religions too, you see, between two branches of, say, the Christian religion, there's not much difference in the way they operate. And yet, if they simply profess small differences of doctrine, that might be enough to produce tremendous wars, right? Because religion has to do with supreme value, right? And so does ideology, right? That the supreme value is the highest value, which takes precedence over other values. And if you once fight over that, then the whole thing, nothing can go straight. I mean, then lying becomes allowed and deception and everything. And that's why religions can't agree. Whatever you say about God, you're talking about that which has supreme value. You cannot possibly negotiate or compromise on that. And in fact, even though you are almost the same religion, small differences of doctrine, it's enough to produce tremendous wars. Now, small differences in doctrine and politics can produce tremendous wars or tremendous conflicts if the politics is given supreme value, right? If the ideology behind it. Therefore, values are tremendously powerful, you see. Even when people don't believe in them, the merely to profess them is tremendously powerful. If they believe in them, it's immensely more powerful. Therefore, values require attention. Now, you see, this is not something which is common in our culture, you see. People say, well, you've got to say something about your values. Some people say, well, we're going into relativism, all values are relative, we should go back to absolute values. But you see, that's a very superficial sort of thing, because the reason we've got relativism is that the absolute values don't make any sense, right? But relative values don't make any sense either. You see, if you say all values are relative, then how will you determine anything, right? Relative to what? Therefore, we seem to be in a crisis of values, because the absolute values, in the past people had the eternal verities, you know, about whatever they were, God, country, family, hard work, honesty, you know, character.
Would you say that identification is also a value?
Well, it will involve values, because you are trying to identify yourself with qualities that have high value, right? You don't want to identify yourself as valueless. Saying I'm a worthless nothing, you see.
It's not
Some people do, but then that's masochism. Right?
But that's not a conscious process.
It's tacit, it's implicit, it's picked up from the society, your parents, your friends, your country, your teachers, you know, everything, right? What you read. And you see, but these values permeate everything, right? And yet we pay very little attention to them. Sometimes we have we think about them and say we must have better values, you see, but that's not much use, you see. How are you going to decide what values to have? You will have to have some other values by which you judge which values you're going to keep, and or else it'll be arbitrary and say whatever I like or whatever my parents thought or, you know, whatever God told me. See, unless we know we have a direct line to God, then it's just a guess, right? You'll have to take somebody's word for it, but then does he have a direct line? So you see, and then so what are we going to do about these values, right? You know, we can't ignore them because they rule us, right? If we ignore them, they're going to rule us. They're going to lead us in every direction. They take power, you see. We may think we're choosing, but we're not. The values are choosing, right? We choose according to the values, right? That's inevitable. But if we have values, that determines the choice, right? and therefore, the question of values is one which requires attention. I'm saying, what does it mean to give attention to values? Well, we have to see how they operate, you see. First we need to see, instead of saying our values are a problem, you see, that will lead us astray. It'll be part of that web of mistakes, you see. How can you treat values as a problem? You know, that would suggest, well, I have certain values and I must get myself to have some other values, or we must impose some other values. But we've seen that sort of thing is just contradiction, right? Confusion, chaos.
Seems it leads us in two directions or something. One question is, values must be part of that hierarchy of thought that we talked about yesterday, the ordering. There's thought, and then they are decided, like the things we were talking about, anger. The things we get angry about are the things we give value to.
Yes.
So then the value is a step up or into, or, you know. So then the question is, our values always are arbitrary, or is there some way for a value to have some meaning that goes beyond the arbitrary?
Yes, that's the question. We have to discover that. If we made a judgment, an arbitrary assumption about that, now that would not help us, right?
But I'm just saying that seems to be the direction.
That's the direction we're moving, yeah.
Okay.
You see, we have got to discover something. You know, we can't look to authority. In the past, most people have looked to authority to answer that question, or they have said, I answer it according to the way I like it or how I feel. Or something, but none of these is adequate.
Well, maybe values are a little like words in the dictionary. Just because they're there, you don't have to use them all, but I don't think we can do without them altogether. I am a person completely without values. That doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't. No, it's a subtle question, you see.
Yeah.
That it requires some attention, some thought too, some really correct thought.
It's the question of which values have value.
So that's an important point. You see that which values have value, but there's another question in that we also value our values. You see, that which is one reason why we hold them, right? You see, for example, suppose you have a value that, I don't know, you say hard work is my value, and by having that value, I'm mobilized to action, to work hard, and I feel good inside because everything is moving and I have energy and so on. So I say, my state of feeling good inside is also a value, right? And now, if I can't work, then I say I don't feel good inside, right? Therefore, indirectly, I'm valuing my value, you see. By valuing the good feeling, I'm valuing the value which helps me produce it, namely hard work.
Then we can see that self-deception is very closely tied in with this value thing, huh?
Yeah. Yes, you see, so to come back, then, I value Originally, I valued hard work for various reasons. You see, saying it's good, it produces good results, you know, it's orderly and so on. And now I'm valuing it for another reason, which is that it makes me feel good. It makes me feel somehow I'm doing something important, and, you know, it makes my life have meaning. And therefore, if I can no longer work hard, I feel rather bad. Either I may not be, I may be unwell, or maybe there's no work to do, maybe, you know, or something, there's nothing to be done. And so then I feel uncomfortable because one of my values is not being realized, right? You see, so therefore we get into this web of entanglement by valuing our values without realizing that that's happening, right?
And professing to have values that we have deceived ourselves into believing that we have that we really don't have.
Yes, well, we may profess values that we don't have, and that that creates conflict because our other values that we do have make us want to do one thing, and our professed values make us want to do another. See, that's the sort of thing that gives rise to corruption in society, is that people profess honesty and so on, and but they also have other values, which is, you know, they want to get ahead and make money and do whatever they want to do. And the profession of honesty actually helps to encourage corruption, right? That was brought out by Veblen, Thorstein Veblen, in the 19th century. In the United States, there was a strong populist movement against having powerful, wealthy combinations, and they developed laws against that. But after the Civil War, they began to develop the country in the West, and these companies, in order to do this thing at all, they needed to violate all those laws, right? Either they had to stop this development or to change the law or violate it. They couldn't change it because it went against the professed values of the country, right? So the way around it was corruption, right? You see, corruption is one of the ways by which we get out of this conflict, but by producing another one. And I think you'll find in every country of the world there is corruption, and that this corruption comes because the professed values are getting in the way of what has to be done.
It seems that the ego, thought, and values seem to be enmeshed together.
Yes, values are a key part of the ego and of thought, right? If without values, you would hardly bother to think. And what would be the point of thinking except that somehow it has value, right? There's a goal you want to achieve. Purpose and value and meaning are closely related, right?
Would you say a good deal of the problems of the world are caused by our ego?
Yes, but what is the ego? See, it's like the onion. You take off all the layers, there's no onion, right? If you remove all sorts of things, you know, like values and this and that, where will be the ego? You see, values are a key factor of the ego, right?
And thought.
And thought. And also much more than thought, because values are a part of meaning, right? Which may go beyond thought. There may be a value beyond thought, you see, which
that's
we could perceive. Yes. When we use the word meaning, that also has it means significance, purpose, intention, and value, right? See, I mean to do it as purpose. It has great meaning, great value, right? Right? That is, life loses its meaning. You really mean life has lost its value. And that has gone on for ages. People have complained of that. You see, like, you know, in Ecclesiastes it says, you know, vanity of vanity is always vanity, right? So at least several thousand years ago that problem was there. This question of value is very, very powerful and pervasive. We can't just dismiss it or condemn it or push it, put it aside. Right? There is the whole question of meaning. Without value, nothing would ever get done. You see, value is priority, right? In terms of the highest value is the highest priority. We're saying in order to climb Everest, they had to give that high value. And mediocrity means climbing halfway up, means that you have other values that prevent you from doing what you really want to do, right? That's why people are mediocre, that they may have a really good value, but then they find out there are some other values, such as being safe and comfortable and secure and, you know, not being disturbed and so on. And those are also values, right?
We're using meaning and value in different ways.
But that's part of the meaning of meaning is value, right?
Right.
Right? And part of the meaning of meaning is significance, and part of it is purpose, right? And they're all interconnected, right? Because what is significant will have high value. And if you have a purpose, then you must be giving something of value to have a purpose, right? You would have no purpose without a value.
we get back to the ego then.
Well, but also to something beyond the ego, because we can't dismiss all purpose and value and meaning as just due to the ego. Now, that would be an assumption which I think would get in the way.
It seems like that we're talking about values that maybe could be called human values or social values, but the whole feeling that there's such a thing as value must arise out of some kind of natural order. And maybe that's the place where the values that wouldn't be disruptive arise.
Yeah, it might arise from a natural order. You see, suppose you say that the beauty of nature felt to be a high value. Now, is that just due to social conditioning, or is that something deeper?
Well, it would be hard to say. But is there such a thing in the universe of the natural order as values? Seems to me would have to be asked. Otherwise, they're all social, all human values.
Yes, well, that's a question where I don't know if we can answer that at this stage, but whether there is value beyond human value.
You see, definitely, that seems to be...
Yeah, now, people have proposed that. For example, those who believe in religions say that the whole world has a value through God, God had a purpose to create the universe, which gives it value, right?
But that appears to be a human social...
It appears to be, but in the past people believed it wasn't, right?
Well,
and those who are religious still believe it's not, hmm? You see, in other words, they are confronting the question, perhaps wrongly, or may not agree with it, but at least one has to look at what they're doing, right? Now, those who are deeply religious feel that they have a value which is beyond human values. Those who don't believe in it say, you have only invented all this and said, attribute it to God. Hmm?
So, but is there the very concept, anything that we come up with in our brain, must have some root in something that's beyond what we've come up with.
Yes, it must, but at least we're supposing so, and it seems reasonable. Now, then, we have to come to that. I think that we should aim at seeing what is the true source of value, let's put it that way. Is there a true source of value beyond all this we've been talking about? And I think we'll come to that gradually, you see. There are all sorts of false sources of value, which we have been talking about. But we have to clear up these false values to some extent, you see, to get into that.
Right.
Because we could say that the mind and the society and the culture are pervaded with false values. And that is true over the whole world and has been true for a long, long time. And therefore, it affects us, right?
Well, you mean like, I am a rich man and I intend to be a rich man, so I hire a lot of soldiers and put the rest of you inferiors to work for me, and this is entirely proper because I am superior to you, or I couldn't have done it to you.
Yes, so you say, I have very high value and you don't. You see, but in earlier societies this was an accepted principle, saying the nobleman had a higher value than the peasant, right? Therefore he could live a different life and the peasant had to serve him.
Yeah.
You see, but within the order of society, the nobleman and the king had the higher value, right? And if the absolute king, his will had supreme value in the sense that he could, in principle, just do anything, although in practice was limited, but the principle of it was that he was absolute, right? Yeah. Absolute means independent altogether, right?
Hmm. In his presence, you have to be flat on your face.
Well, inwardly, in the sense that... even if the king pretended that he were treating you as an equal, that this was very dangerous because he might go back to his other role any time. And the
absolute value is unlimited value.
Yeah, unlimited value. Absolute means completely independent of everything else, and therefore unlimited, right?
Isn't the ego is the trunk of the tree and creates all the branches of values?
Yes, the ego, we'll find ultimately that the ego is the absolute, supreme, unlimited value. But see, that's so the first thing is to see, if we're looking for a true source of value, which in some sense would have to be unlimited, we are not going to find it if we are blinded by this false, unlimited value that pervades everything. You know, it's like saying, you know, in Las Vegas you have all these lights, which you can only see the lights and you'll never see the universe, right? Until the lights are turned off. So as long as the lights are on, it seems that they are the universe, right? Hmm? See, so our values which pervade our lives and our society seem to be what is. See, people say, be practical, you know, be realistic, right? all of this is a dream. You see, this anybody could react that way, right? All we've been talking about is just a pipe dream. You know, be realistic. The values of society are such and such. You must adjust to them and make your way. Realism is what's called for. But you see, these values are pure based on fantasy, right? I mean, look at our society. Fantasy is the supreme value, almost. I mean, even leading aside all this ideology and nationalism and all this religious conflict and so on, just simply watch the advertisements, right? Where you will see the values of the society displayed. Right? And they are fantasy, you see. In order to sell a car, what you do is you create a fantasy. You see, you have a television program, you have a nice car there, and some man gets in and he starts driving the car, obviously enjoying himself and you know, very happy at how skillful he is at driving this wonderful car. And you know, seeing somebody else is there admiring the whole thing and so on and so on. Now this fantasy helps to sell the car, right? Now without this sort of fantasy, it would be hard to maintain our industries in the present situation, right? And people would not buy enough with all these things, and they would be out of work, right? Now, so, and if you watch what's going on in politics, you have recently seen demonstrations in the realm of fantasy. Now, the the point is then, say, people, when they say be realistic, they mean accept all the currently accepted fantasies and try to make your way on that basis, right?
That includes the stock market.
Yeah, well, that was another one, you see. I mean, that was pure fantasy. The money, the value of the thing was just whatever people believed it to be, right? And so therefore, value was determined by fantasy, right? Now, because everybody wanted to believe that it had a high value, therefore they bid against each other and it got a high value. And we're saying now that we're in this peculiar situation where we have all these values. They are false values based on fantasy and arbitrary assumption and heaven knows what else. You know, and people and these control us and dominate us. Value is very powerful. We can't do without it. We have got to have some reasonable, orderly, right values of some kind. It doesn't seem that we have any values which would enable us to choose the right values, right?
Aren't we saying that somehow inquiry has to be the highest value?
Yeah. Well, at this moment, anyway, for this period when we're working, our highest value is a free inquiry, right? But we've said to be open, to be able to see, and we discovered that we can't see, that we have got other values, right? And therefore, we have got to see that. Right? You see, other values may come in saying, you know, it's too uncomfortable to see and so on. But we've got to see that, right? And you know, you may say, I don't really want to see. So you may then discover, I don't really want to see, right? I say the highest value is to see it, yet I discover I don't want to see, right? When I do this. So I've got to acknowledge that, because I may have the highest value that I've got to have a good image of myself, which is that since the highest value is to see, it's also, I must deny that I don't see and say that I do see, whether I do or not. So that's my highest value, right? So therefore, one way out. The other way is to say, okay, I don't see. It's hopeless. You know, I am unable to see, and so on. You see, that gets me off the hook. You see, but of course, it stops the inquiry, right? You see, so therefore, all these thoughts by which you think about your problem are the problem at this moment, right? You see, so people keep on thinking, what is my problem? How am I going to see? How am I going to get the energy to see? Right? I don't see, right? Now I'm putting it in that way. I don't see. You see, I'm thinking about myself. I'm a person who doesn't see. So I've introduced the observer and the observed. And now that very thought is my problem at this moment. As long as I'm thinking that thought, I'm not going to see, right? Hmm. Is that clear?
Well, if I see that I am afraid, therefore I create governments, I am afraid, therefore I create churches, I am afraid, therefore I create insurance companies, and then I give all of these things very, very high values because I am afraid, and value is what will cure the fear.
Yes, but what the origin of fear is that you're protecting something which you regard as a supreme value. You see, there's another value behind the fear. You see, fear can only arise when something of value is threatened.
Good, yeah, good.
Right? If yourself happens to be the highest value, then you will be afraid when yourself is threatened, right? Mm. You see, if you think something else is a very high value, whatever it is, you will be frightened when that is threatened.
We keep saying that we can't live without values or without meaning, but it seems that we keep saying that all meaning and all value is sort of an arbitrary thing.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just pointing out where it is arbitrary.
Well, we're not saying which, that we can't live without it or that it's not arbitrary.
I'm not saying that it's arbitrary. I'm saying most of what we happen to have around us is arbitrary.
All right, well, then I'll say it's arbitrary.
What?
Then I will say it's arbitrary in that we have to get through the arbitrariness of all of this, and we'll come to a place where we don't have any values.
Apparently not, but you see, there may be other values which
well,
are...
Well, then those other values would manifest themselves, possibly, but within all of this, there's no room for them to manifest.
Yeah, so you have to face something very difficult. You say, we do not know if these other values will come or not.
Right.
We hope they will, and so on, and maybe they will, but... Meanwhile, we are in danger. We seem to be in this danger. We are going to strip ourselves of all our values.
All right.
Life will have no meaning.
It's like a transitional phase.
Yeah.
That question was asked yesterday, why are we afraid of being nothing?
Yeah.
Being nothing means having no value.
No value and no meaning, right? People say life is meaningless. If you have no values, what does your life mean, right?
But that may be a necessary direction.
It may be. You see that. Therefore, we have the thought that this is too dangerous or too bad or too unbearable or something, right?
Which means we're still holding on to something we value.
Yeah. So, see, we're saying something we value would be threatened by facing this, right?
Right. Hmm? Stripping away rather than discovering.
That's right, yes. So, see, if we say, it seems I see that I must get free of all false values. Hmm? That seems very clear. But then I also, in the back of my mind, tacitly, implicitly, perhaps unspoken, is the thought, what will happen to me if I do?
Right.
Hmm?
Right.
And that's enough to stop it. You see, then there will be fear because something of value, of great value apparently, is being threatened.
So fear is sort of a sign to tell us where to look for these values that
we're
not willing to look
at. You have to ask about the fear. Is there something genuine that is... See, fear is originally an animal reaction which would alert you to danger. Right. Now, but if we are alerted to an image of danger or false danger, the fear is destructive. So is either something of real value is threatened or something of false value is threatened, right?
And that brings us back to that question.
Right.
That point of what's real and what's illusion.
Yeah. The true value and the false value, you see. So but I think before we can do that, there are a number of questions we have to go into, you see.
But this is a good time to think.
Yeah, I think it would be a good time to stop now. I'll just finish this statement that there are some false... We have to get through not only... get a feeling for these false values and for some things behind them, like the ego. And then we can begin to raise the question of what could be meant by the true values.